Jabs at holes, guardian ring, spin let loose, but wearing thin, wearing thin, but biting through the shift in power leans to you, and the corner.
Good morning. Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, and this is Locust Focus, Wednesday morning call-in talk radio. And my name is Erin Sexton Saylor. You're not used to hearing my voice. I'm usually in the booth pushing all the buttons. But today, Barbara is in the booth pushing all the buttons, so welcome her to that change in roles. And the reason that I'm hosting today is because we decided to do a special show on a topic that's near and dear to my heart. We're going to talk about lesbian parenting. And the reason that we're doing that is that I am I'm taking about 6 weeks off starting after this show because my partner, Melissa, is due in 13 days. Yay! Applause, applause. She's hanging in there. But she's due in about 13 days with our first child, purported to be a little girl, according to the ultrasounds. And we're really excited about that. And one of the things that Barbara and I have been talking about over the last few months is the state of lesbian parenting in Portland and sort of how it's changed and grown and decisions that women are making to become parents. So I have invited two guests today, Myra Lavenue, who is mother of 17-month-old Aria Lavenue, wife of Elizabeth Lavenue, and co-founder of PLOP, which is an informal... You'd say informal?
Definitely informal.
An informal group of lesbians called Parenting Lesbians of Portland. However, I know it's not just for lesbians with children. It's for lesbians who are interested in parenting or supporters of lesbian parents, correct?
Yes, and we just welcomed our first transgender couple last week.
Excellent. And I also have with me here today Gina Frazzini. And Gina Frazzini is mom to... might I add, adorable, 21-month-old Emmett Rocco, and partner to Katie Parman. And thanks for being here, Gina.
You bet.
So there are so many topics to cover, and I just wanted to start out by giving a caveat. We decided to keep the focus of this show fairly narrow because queer parenting is a huge topic area. But I wanted to have folks in to talk today about specifically lesbian parenting in Portland and to talk with women who have decided in as lesbians, as single lesbians or as lesbian couples decided to parent and to go the procreative route as opposed to the fostering, foster parenting or adoptive routes. And the reason we wanted to do that is because there's a lot to talk about there. And there's a lot of decisions that women have to make. And I think that a lot of people, there's a lot of confusion about what happens. The first thing that people I know say to me is, oh, really, can I ask you about... And then they proceed with some really personal question, which is fine. I actually welcome that kind of stuff. But I wanted to really get into this topic. So that's why it's sort of narrow. And this is also a call-in talk show. So our phone number is 503-231-8187 if you want to join in on the conversation. First of all, I just want to have my guests here talk a little bit about how they decided to become parents. So I want to start with you, Myra.
One of four children in my family has just always been, I'm going to have children. It's something that I was looking for in a partner. Was married for many years in New York City, and when I realized I was a lesbian, I moved here to Portland, and I kept looking for the chance to be a parent, and found a few different partners in when I first moved here that wanted children, but Elizabeth is who I ended up with as far as the commitment was there and the love was there and definitely our commitment to having children was primary in the relationship from the get-go.
Well, I think that was true for Katie and I as well, as we both came into the relationship agreeing that we at some point wanted children, although we had no idea how that would happen or if it would happen. And early on, we had the pleasure of helping to raise our nephew for quite a few years from the age of about 2 to 6. He lived with us off and on and has always been a big part of our family and continues to be. So it was, I think the toughest part was deciding at what point we felt quote-unquote ready, which we realized eventually that we never would feel entirely ready. But also where we felt that our relationship was safe enough or protected enough legally, not in terms of our commitment to each other, because that had been solid for years before we made the decision to have a child. But we spent quite a bit of money on legal paperwork and doing as much as we could at the time to safeguard our relationship and protect our family, which is still pretty, can be pretty uncomfortable.
Absolutely. And that actually segues nicely into a discussion about sort of the methods that we decided to use to become parents, because, like I said, I wanted to sort of focus on the procreative, but that actually leads to an entire new set of questions. And one of the reasons I asked you guys specifically here is because we've got a couple of different ways of bearing children represented. And I want you to talk a little bit about which way you decided to go with and why. So, Myra, go ahead.
Initially, we actually asked my brother, and he said yes, and we drew up the legal paperwork, and when it wasn't coming back, and it didn't come back, and it didn't come back, I finally said, have you changed your mind? And it confessed he had. He'd always wanted a girl, and he had a new girlfriend, and he was afraid he wouldn't be able to let go of the dad as opposed to donor. And so then we decided OHSU was a great anonymous sperm bank right here in our own fair city. I went down there and just found it to be a wonderful place, very welcoming, both to us as a lesbian couple, and very knowledgeable on fertility issues in general. And I found somebody who matched my profile, as far as I figured Elizabeth was bringing her 50% to the table and genetically, and I it was really up to me to find my 50% in the donor. And they have a public donor registration where you can read everything about these folks and not have to pay your way through. There are the Cryobank of California. I think you have to pay incrementally the more and more information,
you get. Yeah.
So I found within 5 minutes somebody who matched, I felt, me pretty well, outgoing, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant with some French thrown in there, but extroverted, green or blue eyes. I just wanted to kind of go with a light colored eyes and a blonde hair, and she looks a lot like me. It's kind of amazing.
Awesome. Great.
It's interesting, all of us in the room are the
other mothers, and I cannot wait to talk about that. We're going to do it, babies. We're going to do it.
And this question is interesting, too, because, of course, it's the first thing that anyone asks you, almost, whether they know you or not.
I like wheat checks, too. Say, tell me about it.
Now, how did your partner get pregnant? How does that work? Let's see. Katie and I were really interested in keeping the experience as personal as possible for us, and we lucked out in that we spent, we thought about this for years, and I think we were together for 6 years before we started the process, and so we kind of had a running joke between us about different men in our lives that they were on the short list, that kind of thing. And it just turned out that a very dear friend of ours was someone that we, between the two of us, had talked about asking if he'd be willing to be a donor. And that was my job, as Katie was going to do the heavy lifting in terms of carrying the child. I had to go out and
hunt and gather,
pretty much. So it just really, we were so lucky and so blessed in that sitting down to talk to our friend. His initial reaction was very positive, and the more we talked about what we were looking for from both sides, his needs and desires about being a part of this and our needs and desires, the more we found that it all lined up. And so that was really wonderful. But it was also interesting because I talked to a friend of mine. He's an older guy out in D.C. who had agreed to help a lesbian couple to get pregnant. And he cautioned me, be careful, because you never know what's going to happen once that baby comes. And his agreement with his friends had been that he would be the donor at a distance, and they would raise the child and that kind of thing. Well, the child was born, and everything changed in the couple's relationship. He ended up taking on a much larger role as a parent. And it turned out, it was not what he imagined for himself. It was not what they had imagined for their family. And in the end, it ended up being something wonderful for them. So we had to be, I guess, prepared for that possibility. And so far, everything continues to be really wonderful, and the friend continues to be a part of our life. He's an uncle to our child, and we feel really lucky because we did everything at home, and it worked out.
I think one of the that's one of the challenges that you have to face is the personal connection. I know that we had one friend who we asked to be a donor, and his partner objected on the basis that it's not just, you don't just get to make those personal decisions for yourself, you're also making them for your child in the future. And one thing that I didn't realize is that we could sign as many legal documents as we wanted saying, he's not the father, he's not the father, we're both the mothers, blah, blah, blah. But you can never fully exempt your child from that person's life if you know who they are. And if we were to die suddenly in a car crash, God forbid, our child could seek financial compensation from that donor because he was known and therefore he's the parent and they can seek child support. Which, it's, I think, one of the interesting things that lesbians get to do is go through all of the most horrible case scenarios and the financial scenarios when you're looking at forming your family, because that's where the danger, I mean, besides the obvious emotional trepidation of not knowing who's going to, decide to object to your family, you also put yourself in some legal and financial danger, and on both sides. And I know that's not the fun part of parenting, is to think about those things, but we do have to think about them. We do have one. We have a caller on the line, so I'm going to take that call. Hi there, caller. Are you on the air?
Hi there. Hey, I just wanted to add a quick thing. I'm a parent of four children, and it's difficult to raise children in today's society. And I think what you're talking about is not good for the kids. And to raise a child with a surrogate father and two female parents, and I mean, there's just so many scenarios that you go to. The children are mean to children, and it's not a traditional family home setting with two female parents or two male parents.
Okay, I guess the caller's gone now. So, who would like to respond to this gentleman?
I was raised by a single mom. Does that mean I'm not a healthy woman?
My family didn't have as much money as the people I grew up around, and my parents were, I was a chubby kid, and I got teased a lot, and I have a really bad last name, and I got a lot, Sexton. I mean, come on, think about it, okay? Third graders. And well, it was hard.
Caller mentioned that kids are mean to kids, and where do they learn that? They learn that from their parents. Children need loving, consistent care in their lives, whether that's one parent, two parents, a whole, house full of parents. And, so.
My daughter's been raised by an entire community.
Right.
I live with four other adults, and there's quite a lot of extended family, and I mean non-genetic related, you know, family, but I can't imagine a more healthy place for her to grow up than, you know, basically in its own, her own little village of loving people.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that Gina mentioned was how deliberate our becoming parents has been. Mm-hmm. You know, she and Katie waited 6 years. There's hardly ever do people wait that long to have children, and I think that it's evidence of the thought and care and love that she and her partner put into this decision, and I know that I put the same care and thought into this decision. So I think that as far as, you know, the health of the family that our child is being born into, there's no question about how healthy and stable and supportive,
you know,
it is.
But the points he brings up as well, it's like, I don't think a single couple in that I've met has not thought thoroughly through, you know, I have a boy, you know, what male father figures can I bring into my child's life? Or I have a female and I'm a gay dad, you know, how can I get, you know, some a mother figure in her life? And I think we all think about it, making sure that we all want to raise the healthiest kids we have and give them role models.
Once again, you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, and the phone number to call in to join in the conversation is 503-231-8187. And I'd especially like to hear from lesbians who had children who are now in their teens or early 20s. So women who gave birth in the 70s or 80s or became parents in the 70s or 80s, just so that we can get a little bit of a historical perspective, because we all, what's represented in this room are parents of young kids or soon-to-be young kids. I think one thing that Myra brought up was the aspects of choosing the aspects of the donor that you chose. And I think that's an interesting thing that we get to do, is choose a donor based on some different criteria than other people perhaps choose who's going to parent their child. And I know for us, relative physical similarity to me as the non-carrying partner was really important. Was that a factor, Gina, for you guys when you chose your donor, as who is also a friend?
Not so much, not in that same way. It sounds like what you two are saying is that you were looking for someone who is physically similar to the non-bio mom, and we were more interested in the, because of the fact that we were looking for someone who, I mean, that's a very intimate situation to be in with a dear friend. So we were looking for someone who we felt could handle that, in a sense, and be honest with us and have some very detailed, deep conversations about very personal issues and that kind of thing. And I have to admit, we were looking for a redhead, which is not actually my coloring, but
it's your chosen
color. Katie's a redhead, and we just wanted to carry that on. So far, we've got the blondest baby.
It was a little red when he was a baby, though.
Yeah.
It was strawberry blonde.
I think it'll come back around. So, you know, so that was really important, the quality of our relationship with the friend. And then we were also looking for things like, you know, he's very bright, and I hope he's listening. Bright and kind and, you know, red-haired, tall.
Tall. That was a big one for me. Tall and thin, because those are things that my family is not. I wanted to take another caller because we have a couple people waiting on the line. Hello, caller? You're on the air.
Are you talking to me?
I guess I am. Hi.
Good. Hi. I'm calling. I just wanted to say that I'm a straight parent, two-parent household of middle school age kids, and it was really scary to me just to think of all the teasing that would go on anyway when my kids entered school. But it, after a while, and both of my kids have been in their circles of friends, have been friends with at least one child from a lesbian household. They aren't friends with any kids from two gay men as parents. But and what was really clear to me as I grew older is that kids tease kids for just about any reason. Your nose is a little pointy. Any reason, and no matter how loving and empathetic you are as a parent, at least we feel this way, your kids also do some of the teasing, and it does happen. It's actually even harder to accept that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to throw that out there, that what's important is that kids have loving parents, whether those parents are, you know, a group, a commune, or one single parent that's a loving figure in their life. Statistically, kids do better that way. Anyway, I just want to throw that out there. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Yeah, I think that that which does not destroy you can only make you stronger. Kind of method of parenting I tease pretty mercilessly as a kid.
I think it's the main reason we try so hard to pick a name is like you try to think of every possible teasing.
That's really true. Well, and I just want to say, too, though, that I think that, you know, it would be interesting to hear from lesbian parents or gay parents who raised kids, you know, a decade or two ago, because things are very different now. I mean, one of the things that we have going for us in a way that I guess our those who came before us didn't, is that we're much more out and open about our lives and our families. And, you know, we talk to our kids. We're involved in groups like PLOP that help to foster a sense of not being alone. You know, our children are going to be raised in a community that we value all kinds of families. And we're not just, you know, it's not just something that we quietly keep to ourselves. We're out and proud, you know?
Excellent. So we have another caller. So, caller, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I missed the last couple minutes of the show. I couldn't hear what you were saying, but if I could just make a quick comment and then a question about the guy who called in a few minutes ago and, you know, disagreed with the whole idea of lesbian parenting. And one of the women's defense was that she was raised in a single-parent family. Well, so was I. I was raised by my mother alone. I mean, there was a stepfather there for a while, but basically I was raised by my mother alone. But I think that's quite different from what you're talking about. Even though my father wasn't present, the idea of maleness was there, that this was not the norm I still had male role models, maybe an uncle or something like that. Even though he wasn't present, I still had the idea of maleness. And what you're talking about is something altogether different. It's an actual rejection of the idea of maleness. I mean, the way you're talking, it sounds to me, as a male, as a man, it sounds like you've reduced men to this whole process to a very mechanical, impersonal way. And I think that's unhealthy to your view of one half of the human race, that they're totally unnecessary. And I'll listen to your comments. So go ahead and hang up, okay?
Okay, thank you.
It's interesting that the caller would be talking about that. You didn't, I guess, if you knew me, you would think I actually am very, masculine. A lot of my tendencies, I probably know a lot more about sports than anybody around me. Anyway, I have three older brothers, and I can't imagine a more masculine environment to be raised in. I am more comfortable sometimes in the company of men than I am with women. And I often struggle with feeling like I'm still a tomboy in a very feminine world. So I had a lot of male role models in my life, and my father did come and go often, and I did have a stepfather at some point. So I'm not suggesting I raise my daughter in an incubator with only feminine energy around her. I'm actually, she's got an adopted grandparent here in town because my parents are both passed on, and he's in her life weekly. We also have many male friends that come by, and I want her to have male role models in her life. I do not want her to be raised only with with a feminine role model or with me as a substitute, that would not be in any way equivalent to all the wonderful richness a man can bring to her life.
Yeah, I think that that I reject that wholeheartedly. Our daughter has two living male grandparents who intend to be extremely active in her life. We are actually part of a church that has the nicest men I've ever met, and I love them, and I trust that they are going to help us. Our whole church is going to help us raise our daughter, and I know that the fathers that I see there and the fathering that I witness there warms my heart, and I want our daughter to have that available to her. I don't think that men are just, you know, some needless half of the human race. Of course not. Actually, my father is one of the favorite people in my life, and I think that the situation is that I'm a lesbian, and there's something in my marriage that other people have that we don't, and that's sperm. And so we sought out a way to get that so that we could grow our family. And that's, you know, that's the reality of our situation. So.
All right. So if there's one thing that hasn't changed, it's that people still think lesbians are man haters.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just
call this what it is
because, you know, we can talk all day about the efforts we make to, you know, bring caring, loving people into our children's lives, whether they're male or female. And the fact is that we all do the best we can when it comes to our kids. And again, they need consistent, loving care. And that's what, you know, that's what it is our job to give them. And we're going to do that however it takes.
Right on. We've got two more callers on the line, so if you don't mind, we're going to take some calls. But first, I have to announce that you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. If you want to join in the conversation, the number here is 503-231-8187. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Is that me?
I guess so. Hi.
Hi. As someone who can't make a child on my own either, but has parenting issues, or, you know, desire to parent, and I'm just wondering, that I've listened to most of the conversation. No one's mentioned the possibility of adopting. I think that, and I'm just, you know, there is an issue in the world of overpopulation. There are a large number of children who don't have homes. And at least for myself, when I thought about this, it occurred to me that you know, some of my desire to pass myself along genetically was a socially constructed desire, you know, that if I wanted to parent, then I should adopt. And I ended up not doing it. And, well, as a man, I, you know, there's no biological limit on this, but I just wonder why, you know, that subject hasn't been raised in the course of the discussion, how you chose to parent. In other words, the thought was always, we're going to do this, you know, from conception, as opposed to, okay, I want a parent, there are children who need parenting.
I actually,
so some of whom are very little.
One of the things that I did mention at the very beginning of the hour, that's okay, I understand not everybody can join in right at 7:30, but one of the things that I did say is that I wanted to sculpt this conversation around lesbians who chose to procreate. And I actually I'm glad that you brought that up, because that is an issue that I myself have grappled with, because I know that there's overpopulation in this world, and I know that there are many kids. I volunteer with foster kids, and I know that there's many kids who need to be adopted. And that's a good question to pose to the panel here. Why did you decide to go with this route of parenting?
Well, thanks. I hope they'll speak to it, because I think that the fact that parenting and procreating are conflated is a disaster.
Absolutely.
You know, I think also the people who want to be single, but maybe want to have kids in their life, you know, it's like you either you make one, or it's sort of hard to do it. And I think, you know, this is a function of you know, romantic love is a construction of capitalism also. And I just think that
you're breaking my heart.
You know, that parenting needs to be separated out from being with, you know, from procreating and being with children. You know, there's a real disintegration that needs to be addressed, not just by, you know, sperm banks, to be honest.
And I'll let Gina, do you want to start with that?
Sure. I think you know, it is an interesting question, and I think a much larger discussion in terms of the social construction of parenting. The question of adoption, you know, part of the issue in our decision making around this question was the expense related to adoption, and additionally, just the limited ability of same-sex couples to access adoption services. So I think that definitely came up for us, and that's all I have to say on that.
So those kids that are featured every week in the paper, admittedly, those aren't babies, and there's real problems with taking on an 8-year-old child who's been abused or something, but those kids that are shown every week in the paper, I think there's 500 of them at any given time in Oregon, the prejudice is so strong that they, you know, a solid gay couple can't
be considered as
parents for them?
There are quite a few adoption agencies that will not work with same-sex parents and or with single individuals, which same-sex couples are often treated in the system as single individuals. There's a lot of problems with legal rights related to parenting when it comes to same-sex couples. And so in addition to access, funding, you know, finances, it's very expensive to adopt in many cases. But there's also, you know, we were doing our best to safeguard you know, our relationship legally and the rights that we would or would not have to our child, which are still in question, even in a place like Portland, Oregon. And that gets one level more complicated when there's no biological relationship to the child. As it stands right now in Oregon, the biological parent has full, in a same-sex couple, has immediate full rights to parent their child, and the non-biological parent is required to seek a second parent adoption, which is another issue, which is costly as well. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's another issue that maybe we should talk a little bit about, because that's, you know, that's something that my partner and I are involved in a lawsuit that'll be filed next year to change that. And I actually have chosen not to go through that adoption process with my own son, simply because I think that's...
Well, you shouldn't have to.
Exactly.
Well, good for you. Anyway, I apologize for the fact that I really wasn't thinking in terms of prejudice and legal issues.
Oh, no apology. I mean, I think
also,
it's an important discussion.
We're also dealing with women and a biological urge. I mean, there was just no way I was going to stop my wife from having a baby. She was born to have children. She really, really wanted to bear a child. And we've been raised all of our lives as women with that message, and it's very hard to counteract that when you think, I want a child, you can have a child within a year. You know, you have the body capability to bear your own child, and it's why, it's a matter of attention. I hear that your attention was on the children available. There, I didn't even know there was a list in the paper.
One featured every week.
Right, our attention was on how to have a child this way, and it's about choice. If we decided to put everything on the table, we probably would have explored that as well. But our attention always from the very beginning was about having our own child.
Well, and I also think that there's in the way that it's natural. Also, it's also self desire to see yourself reflected in your child. I know that, you know, I cannot wait to look at our baby's face and see my wife in there. That is so exciting to me. And I can't wait to be pregnant, personally. So for our second child, if all goes well, I'll get to carry him or her. And I think it's unfortunate that it seems incongruous with adoption. I think that you can also, you can create a family that's a patchwork of all of these options, as well. And that's something that we've considered. If we decide to grow our family beyond two children, we've considered adoption. But thank you for your call.
All right, well,
I really appreciate your perspective.
Thank you.
And we've got a couple other callers, I guess, waiting on the line. Is that true, Barbara? Yes. Okay. Hello, caller. You're on the air. Guess not.
Well, I'm not sure what the focus of the program is. What is the focus?
The focus of the program is lesbian parenting.
Uh-huh. And, okay. I support your right to have this program there, but here's what I would like to see happen also for people like me. I like to see a regular program run by older women from different walks of life, and I like to see that energy evolve there at KABU, and not older women that are elitist or into that support egotism. So I want to put that energy out. At the same time, I support your right to have your program. Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's one of my regular callers for this show. So she calls in and chimes in on a lot of different subjects. Thank you for calling in and chiming in on this one. I do want to talk about second parent adoptions and the steps that we take to legally insulate our families from the big, bad, nasty world out there. Do you want to talk about second parent adoption? Have you gone through that process,
yes.
Myra?
We have a great lawyer that we used and started the process actually many months before the baby was born. Includes background checks. Since we were in a community household, everybody in my community had to have a background check. And we filled all the paperwork and we were just waiting for the birth date and hour, I believe, and her full name. And I called her from the hospital, left that voicemail, and the paperwork was drawn up. We signed it the week later, and within 3 months, because we chose to be in front of a judge and have an adoption ceremony, I became the legally adopted second parent, the second parent legally adopting my daughter. And as far as the legal risk I still feel, I carry our paperwork with us whenever we travel. We were in Arkansas for 3 weeks this year because I had to close up my family home. So you can bet I had they don't even recognize second parent adoption or the right of same-sex parents to adopt in that state.
Mm-hmm.
They have one fertility clinic in Little Rock, and it's run by people who aren't really open to having lesbian parents. So I carried my adoption papers, my power of attorney with Elizabeth, and she carried mine, healthcare directives. This is not something that other couples have to think about, worry about. But I, no matter what happens anywhere in this country or outside this country, I want to be able to at least have paperwork that says this is my daughter. And this is my wife, and I have the right to make decisions at this point.
Yeah. I think that when we came into the process, I was aware of some of the challenges that you face, not being both biologically related to the child. But it was actually pretty surprising to me. The cost involved is pretty high to go through, and we actually changed our wills before she was born, so we now have wills that say, should, you know, she be born and we not have our second parent adoption in place, her intended parent are, I would be the intended parent, so that's in my wife's will. It also, you know, it doesn't necessarily protect you in other places, and you do have to be on guard all the time about that. I'm curious about what you're doing with the lawsuit, Gina. Can you explain a little bit about that? As much as you can?
Yeah, I have just an aversion to the whole second parent adoption on a gut level. But I also recognize, it's incredibly flawed. The statutes in Oregon, in particular, immediately assign parenting rights to a man who would be in the same situation that we are. If a couple goes through the process of, you know, using a fertility a sperm donor and fertility clinic and that type of thing, the parentage is assumed in a heterosexual couple. And so the only difference, and we've been fighting this, you know, our son is 21 months and we started this the day he was born.
So unmarried or married heterosexual couple?
Either.
Okay.
Unmarried or married heterosexual couple. And we've been told directly from the mouth of Oregon's Attorney General that the statute specifically deals with paternity, and how could that apply to us when, you know, these statutes were written, you know, years and years ago, and it's a pretty, I think it could be a pretty simple change. I should say at this point that, you know, part of my involvement stems also from my work with Basic Rights Oregon, where I've been on the board for a number of years and recently came onto staff. There are, you know, situations across this state where you really get a feel for the problem with this second parent adoption, particularly as it relates to the cost. There's a couple in a rural part of the state who, you know, the first biological mother had their first child. They did the second parent adoption. They were able to afford that. That was no problem. The second pregnancy was carried by the second mother. She ended up birthing triplets. Mm-hmm. And that triples the cost of a second parent adoption. They cannot afford to go through with that adoption. And so they're left with a situation where the birth mother, who is home with the triplets, not working and uninsured, is caring for this couple is left with no insurance for their triplets. The non-biological mother has no legal rights to the kids. I mean, it's an untenable situation. And there's also the fact that you can't do the second parent adoption until you have a live birth. And one of the most dangerous medical situations for a woman to be in is birthing a child. There are all sorts of complications that can happen, and you're left with a family that's completely unprotected until that paperwork goes through after the birth of the child. You know, I know of a story of a woman who, excuse me, was rushed to the hospital with emergency, you know, for an emergency surgery just after the birth of her child, and you know, they're on the phone to the lawyer in the ambulance trying to figure out the best way to safeguard, you know, the family in case things go terribly awry. So
so what are the options?
Well, the options are to change the law, in my mm-hmm. mind. And so so what Katie and I have done is we're working with lawyers that Basic Rights Oregon identified for us who are doing this pro bono. Because talk about costs. I mean, this would be huge, and it's a wonderful gift that there are folks willing to take on this fight. And we're basically positing that the laws need to be updated, and that a couple who intentionally creates a family, creates a child together, should have those rights. There's been some great court decisions out of Washington State and California recently that have basically come to that conclusion. And so I think it's time to update the laws here in Oregon, and I hope that we'll be successful at doing that.
They're coming back to the point of intent.
That's right.
You know, if you're intending and planning a child together as a couple, then you are beginning to already the assumption of parental responsibilities.
That's right.
And all the rights and responsibilities that go along with that.
Right.
And just to clarify, the adoption costs were $1,000. I think they're about $1,000 for people wondering.
It all depends on the lawyer also that you use, because if your lawyer doesn't know exactly what they're doing or haven't done them before, they take more time, and that's more money, because lawyer's time is gold.
Yeah, I've heard it costing as much as $3,000.
Yeah, and so we've heard as low as $700 from our lawyer right now to $1,200, mm-hmm. what he didn't know, 3 months ago. So price dropped.
Well, and I'll also say that that question of intent is so important because, you know, for instance, we filled out the paperwork in the hospital. We had a hospital birth, and Katie put down both of us, you know, as the legal parents on the birth certificate. We turned in the paperwork. We went home with our new baby and got engrossed in that. And the day the birth certificate arrived, we were so excited and opened it up, and I'm not on there. You know, with the stroke of a pen, someone, you know, crossed my name off of my son's birth certificate, and all of a sudden, you know, nothing that you've planned and hoped for and, you know, worked towards matters. It's just the state saying, no, because, you know, because we recognized your name as female, you're out of luck. You know, whereas she could have put any man's name on that birth certificate, regardless of
parentage.
You know, regardless of anything, yeah. She didn't even have to know him. So,
wow, that's astounding. And Emmett was born during that hazy days when we were actually legally married, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was. We got married on our way to the hospital.
So, sort of shifting gears away from the legal aspects and the and second parent adoptions and whatnot, Myra, I wanted you to talk a little bit about PLOP and tell us about PLOP and what it's all about.
PLOP was started by three couples, specifically to support each other. At that point, I believe one of the couples was pregnant, and the other two, the other two of us, were still going to Kaiser and getting inseminated. And after support, after the support around getting pregnant, and at that time we went and we bought legal handbooks for gays and lesbians. I think that's a book, legal handbook for gay and lesbian couples, and we started doing all the planning for and the nesting, and we added more couples and continued to do that. And now it's really about a parenting group raising children in a together with monthly events where our children will end up going to their first year of school feeling that they're already from a normal kind of world where other kids have lesbian moms. I didn't want my child to hit first grade and see no other kids like her. Dan Savage's new book has a story about his six-year-old son and how he's finally throws this huge temper tantrum and says, "You tell me there's other kids with gay dads and I don't ever meet them and I think you're lying." And I just didn't want that with my child. But I tell people that PLOP is for anybody who wants support around getting pregnant, who's just thinking about getting pregnant, wants support around their pregnancy, has questions about being a lesbian mom, or just wants a play group. It's all of that, and it's very informal. We meet once a month. We just have a potluck and a play group, and we always add new members. It's basically whatever people need. Hopefully someday we'll have our own queer center in town, and we can have a big meeting room there. But until then, it's done out of people's homes. So if you're interested in joining, you can certainly, I guess, call KBOO, and you guys will give me a...
Give you a buzz?
Yeah.
Okay. We've been speaking here today with Myra Lavenue, who is a mom and one of the co-founders of PLOP, which is Parenting Lesbians and of Portland. Okay. And, like, and others? No, Parenting Lesbians of Portland. And Gina Frazzini, who is mom to a little boy and also has divulged she's on the BRO board and working for legal change to second parent adoption laws here, in, or to, how would you say that? To laws in Portland, or laws in Oregon.
Parenting rights.
Parenting rights. There
sure.
You go. So I want to talk a little bit more about, oh, I'm sorry, and then I have to give the phone number. I'm not very good at this yet. And I'm Erin Sexton Saylor. And the phone number, if you want to join in on the conversation, is 503-231-8187. I want to talk about social outlets and what it's like to be a lesbian mom in Portland. Because I can't, when I moved here, this is one of the reasons I chose to stay, was that I thought, geez, this would be a fabulous place to raise a kid as a lesbian parent, which I knew I was going to be. So I want to talk about that. And then eventually I'd like to talk about how it's changed your social, and if it has changed your social life and your social group of friends, because I think that's one thing that it must change. Who wants to go first? Gina? Myra?
Repeat the first question for me here.
Well, the first part is, what's the social network like in Portland for lesbian moms? And obviously we have PLOP.
PLOP is now 27 couples large.
Wow. Yeah. Big.
Well, we love PLOP, and so this comment has nothing to do with how great the group is, but sadly, it's the only thing I really know of, you know, and the group has grown incredibly, and I think will continue to grow because every time, you know, you talk to a lesbian couple that's thinking about kids, is pregnant, has kids, is adopting, you know, whatever their situation is, The one referral is PLOP. And we found that it was very difficult to find information and resources. There's that handbook you mentioned. There's, I cannot remember the author's name, but there's this bright yellow book about Pregnancy for Lesbians.
The Ultimate Guide to Lesbian Conception, Pregnancy, and Childbirth by Miriam Taves.
I knew she was.
I'm a little closer to that, you know, just having read it.
Right,
so.
And then there's a whole, you know, set of documents that you can get for free from the National Center for Lesbian Rights, which I want to make sure to put a plug in for, because they're an amazing organization that on the national level has been involved in a lot of the parenting cases. I know particularly the recent decision in California that affirmed the right of same-sex parents. So I think resource-wise, there's a huge gap, and there continues to be, and it's something that I know that Basic Rights Oregon is looking for ways to address. The Q Center is looking for ways to address, and I think, you know, and a lot of other organizations in the area work on family issues. But there's still a huge need out there. And so that's one thing I'll say. Socially, you know, I think that there's a certain amount of novelty to you know, a lesbian parented family that people get really excited about. They get really curious about how does that happen, you know, how do you make those decisions, that kind of thing, some of the things that we've been talking about today. And there's quite a bit of, you know, there's a lot of support. You said that one of the reasons you stayed in Portland was because it seemed like a good place, and that's absolutely true. There's a lot of support.
We have a caller waiting on the line, and I want to take them very quickly here. But another thing that I wanted to mention was that I did, as it was interesting, I was the information gatherer, and Melissa was the chill out and be inseminated person. That was her job, and my job was to gather all the information about tracking fertility, which is something that, you know, I'd never had to do before because I never worried about getting pregnant. But I came across and built up, you know, my own set of resources that I referred to. And one of the things that I wanted to mention is that there are quite a few Yahoo groups and MSN sort of listserv groups that are set up for lesbians who are trying to conceive. And it's a wonderful place to go, and something that if you are out there in this situation, you can find other women in all over the country who are going, and all over the world, quite frankly, who are going through the same sort of situations. And babycenter.com, which is a very mainstream parenting site, yeah, has chat boards, and they have gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender parenting, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender fertility, and a pregnancy group for, and that's relatively new, but I'm lucky enough to be fairly active on that board and get to post to other lesbians who are going, well, how did you know? When did you come out to the family who you're not really close to and didn't really know about you anyway, and now you're going to have a kid? So how did you tell them that? And, well, what about, you know, fertility timing this? Which is better, IUI or ICI, which are different methods of insemination? How much is it costing you for sperm from this bank versus that bank? Because those are all things that are very specific to the situation. So that was one resource I just wanted to throw out there to people. And if the caller's still there holding on the line, I'll take the call.
Yeah.
Hi there.
I tuned in very late. I tuned in, I think, just before the mention of the Big Yellow Book. And this information is probably in the Big Yellow Book, but I'll mention it anyway. As far as second parent adoption, is that the term?
That's one of the things we've been discussing, yeah.
Right, and the woman said with the stroke of a pen her name was...
off the birth certificate, right.
Right. Legal name changes are easy to come by. So in planning this, you know, one of the parents could change their name to a male surname. And that they wouldn't be able to know if you were male or female.
You know what, I think that it's interesting that you raise that question, because there's a lot of, there are a lot of ways that being disenfranchised from our legal rights, we could take advantage of that. For instance, my partner right now is legally a single mother, and with her limited you know, income with, you know, without my contribution, she could very likely qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, for food stamps, for all sorts of government programs that we could be taking advantage of, and choose not to, because, you know, people talk about benefits associated with laws and with legal rights, but there are also responsibilities that come with those. And we have made a very deliberate decision to take responsibility for our family, for our child, to take on the financial costs of raising a child, take on the emotional and, you know, personal costs of raising a child, and do that in a very honest and straightforward way. And so the idea of changing my name, or, you know, I thought about putting my initials, just, you know, my first two initials and my last name, and see if we could sneak it past that way. But the bottom line is that the laws need to be changed, and they need to be changed not just to benefit me and my partner and our son, but they need to be changed to benefit every, you know, every family in Oregon, every same-sex family that is creating, you know, is raising children and creating children and adopting children and all these things.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, except that if you have a legal name change, you're not avoiding any responsibilities and you're not sneaking anything through. It's a.
But I'm a woman.
Uh huh.
So my understanding of what you were suggesting is that I change my name. You know, for instance, I'm Gina, so I change it to John and put my name on the birth certificate.
Right.
Which, you know, that doesn't change. To me, that's sneaky, and it doesn't change anything in terms of.
And it, the principle of the matter is that as lesbian parents, you should be able to put your name on that birth certificate without going through the rigmarole of a second parent adoption, or pretending that you're not what you are, which is a lesbian parent.
That's right.
Right. But actually, that's really interesting that you bring that up, because I think that one of the things that has really surprised me, given the whole marriage debacle we just went through and the ongoing fight to secure the freedom to marry for gay couples, is that many people don't realize the whole host of rights and responsibilities and the associated costs to try to approximate those rights and responsibilities that lesbian and gay and bisexual and transgendered families can encounter. And I think it's good to bring it up, because I can't even tell you how many conversations where they go, what do you mean? You know, you're not, if I'm going to be a stay-at-home parent and I'm going to lose out on Social Security because I'm not playing into Social Security for a very long time. If my partner, if I were a stay-at-home parent for, you know, the remainder of my life, I would be in I'd be in a lot of hot water if I ever went to try to collect Social Security, because although I was contributing in the same way that my partner's mom has to her family's relationship, I wouldn't be entitled to her Social Security benefits because we're not married and we're not allowed to get married. People don't understand that. They don't get that. That if you don't go through the second parent adoption, same thing happens to your non-biological child. If you were to suddenly pass away, they can't get Social Security benefits from that you have paid in. And that's just, you know, one of the factors. So thank you for bringing that up. It's something to talk about. Thanks, caller. Okay. So, Myra, now I wanted to get back to the social part of it and see if you had any other insights for people about, and I wanted you to talk about how it's changed how you socialize in your social group. And
our social group is made up of athletic lesbians and new age straight people and gay and bisexual that came together when we came together as a couple. So we have a whole bunch of new friends, and a lot of them come from PLOP. Though we try to explain to our friends how it is now that we have a child, we can't be spontaneous. We have to plan. We have four or five lovely couples that love to babysit our daughter for free, and we just are so blessed that they give so much support to us. But we have to plan every time we go out. or it's more of a solo thing. We don't do that as much. We make a much bigger effort to be home every night together. And I think about, we try to go on a date once a week, but it's more like probably twice a month. We were at a solstice event this week. She was the only little girl there. This is a bunch of people wanting to do a ritual around solstice. Of course, right when it starts, she decides it's time to freak out. So I have to take her out of the room. And the fact that she's there and the fact that it's 8:30 and we have to go home and it's time for bed. These things have very much impacted how we used to socialize. We also go to bed a lot earlier. We are pretty wasted by 10 o'clock at night or 10:30. We do a lot. I would say most people who know Myron and Elizabeth, they'll be, wow, you guys, you're the couple we want to be when we have a kid, because you're out and you're doing a lot of things. We take her along, contemplating taking her to Cirque du Soleil. I don't know what the thing is, the policy is, but it's like, how can we integrate her into our social life? She's a very social, extroverted little girl and has very few fears around new people because she's been so exposed to so many people. But it has very much impacted who we were as a couple before the child. We are now developing a social life that incorporates her more, and when she's not able to come, it's a lot less frequent than it was before. So there's been a bit of a grieving period, actually. The first 6 months of having a child, it's really, you just realize how much has changed, and then you adapt and realize how much joy you have as well.
And what about other friends? That are there friends that you're not in contact with as frequently?
Oh, the vast majority, yeah. All my friends that are pretty much my athletic, you know, lesbian friends, or my friends from many different other jobs that I cherish, I don't see very often. I think I should make plans with them and or have lunch, but it's really just doesn't happen. I used to go out for drinks after work. I don't do that anymore. I can't just go out for drinks if someone says, let's do it at work. I have to pick my daughter up from daycare. So it's very different. And I say, if you ever wonder what we're doing, we're probably home. So just stop by. As far as other social groups, I'm pretty much with Gina on that. I don't know of others. I know Love Makes a Family. We went to one picnic that they had, and they are gay dads, transgender families, lesbian moms. But I think they do less frequent gatherings, and I know they refer people to Plop. Lesbian moms to Plop. The Q Center, we went to their inaugural Halloween boo ball or whatever they called it. I hope to do more of that. I hope there's more of those events. We always go to Gay Pride, but there's just not that many, you know, events that are gay family focused in town. Mm-hmm. And hopefully that will change as we get more and more consciousness around this, perhaps.
Do you feel, it's interesting because I sort of feel like we're in the middle of a little gaby boomlet, as we call it, gabies. But do you, and because I'm, you know, joining in now, I don't know if my perspective is skewed and all of a sudden I'm seeing gay and lesbian families, transgender, bisexual families where I didn't see them before. Mm-hmm. But do you, is it your sense, especially Gina, who's worked as an activist and in this community for so long, Do you feel like there are more lesbian parents out there nowadays?
I think it is hard because, you know, it's that thing where if you get a certain, you know, like you buy a car, suddenly you notice that car everywhere. I have a hard time with that, just being in the center of it. But it does feel like there's a bit of a boom. And it's certainly more... people are much more interested in finding community around parenting than what I've seen before. But again, I don't know if that's just a...
The latest issue of Love Makes a Family's newsletter says there's a baby boom going on right now. Huh. And I don't know where Bonnie gets her information, but there does seem to be a reputation now of it starting.
Yeah.
Well,
every time you turn around, it seems like another... another lesbian couple is pregnant or in the process of adopting or,
creating their family.
That's right.
I wanted to mention again, this is KBOO Portland, and if you want to join in the conversation we're having this morning, the phone number to call is 503-231-8187. I'm here with Myra Lavenue, who is a co-founder of PLOP, which is Parenting Lesbians of Portland. She's also the mother to Aria, a 17-month-old girl. And Gina Frazzini is my other guest. She is mother to 21-month-old Emmett Rocco. And she's also involved with Basic Grades Oregon as a board member. And it looks like we do have another caller, so I'd like to take that call. Caller, you're on the air.
Thank you. Recently I joined the faith-sharing group with a group of Catholic people. And I'm a very unlikely, I mean, I don't fit the profile of someone that would be in such a group. But I find it enlightening and enriching, even though I have, and they know that I have no desire to convert or anything like that, you know. And two men in the group are homosexual. And the whole time I've been in that group, I've thought about some of the things that you're talking about. And I wonder, are there any groups that foster better relations, more community with heterosexual people? You know, in other words, a group that is reaching out to heterosexual people.
Are you talking about a gay group that tries to go out and build better relationship with the heterosexual world?
Not so much that, but just maybe. Yeah, I guess you could say that, maybe. You know what I'm saying? For instance, all as I listen to you, I hear about everything is inter, you know? And it seems to me that there should be heterosexual people who, for instance, I saw an ad for a tenant, a house-sharing situation, and it said they were looking for a gay or a gay-friendly person, you know? So I guess it's the gay-friendly part that I'm referring to that should be a relationship between so-called gay-friendly people.
Okay, I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at, but what I'm hearing you say is that you're interested in hearing about people who are forming alliances between their lives within the gay and lesbian community and with the rest of the non-gay and lesbian world.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know that I don't know if there's any formally organized groups. I know that groups like Basic Rights Oregon involve a lot of allies, people who are supportive of our families and of our community. And I also think that even though what we're talking about here is generally gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender-specific groups that we turn to for support, because you realize we're talking about parenting in a world where this is not the norm and where there are a lot of issues that come up for families like ours, due to this fact that we are gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgendered people. But we also interact with the rest of the world on a daily basis. I know that I mentioned the church that I go to. That's one place where I build very strong alliances and have a lot come to understanding with a lot of folks. We're not the only parenting lesbian couple, well, almost parenting, we're on our way, lesbian couple within our congregation. But, you know, we have contact with them. We see them weekly. We share social hours with them and family and church events. And through that, we are building alliances with all sorts of families, quite frankly. And I guess this is the women's studies major in me coming out. But I think that for to expect a group of people who are experiencing a certain oppression to be the ones to initiate and sustain outreach to the larger community is a little bit it's putting the burden back on the people to whom the burden should not fall. It's not my job, although I do a lot of ambassadoring. I do a lot of talking to people who've never talked to somebody who's gone through the process of becoming pregnant as a lesbian. And I'm very open, and I'm willing to answer just about any question. But it's not within my range of responsibility to take that on, because I have to protect my family and worry about supporting us in a world that's more hostile to me than I am to it. Thanks. you guys have anything to say about that? Sorry.
You took a lot of the same points I was going to make, is that it's like we swim in a huge ocean of heterosexuality, and we have these small islands of lesbian, you know, safe holds. You know, I've created it in my home. I've created it with Plop. And I work and witness constantly as, in a way that's very open. I talk about my daughter. I talk about my wife. I talk about all the issues. I talk about, hey, call this person right now. You know, let's get this legislature to vote our way. It's not about living in isolation. We just by who we are and how we live our life, I think we are always reaching out in just a very normal interaction and educating just by being who we are.
Excellent. And Barbara, am I correct that we have another caller? I guess we do. Okay, caller, you're on the air? Caller, are you there? No. Yes. Yes.
Hello.
Hi, caller.
Hi there. That last caller, he did have an interesting point about socializing with heterosexual couples, of course, but my question is more scientific. Could you make it legal rights to both parents if one of the parents donated the egg and the other carried the infant in pregnancy? Would that change anything on the law, on the birth certificate, and so forth?
It's interesting that you bring that up. Excuse me, because it actually differs from state to state, and I believe in Oregon, this does not solve the issue. One parent is still required to do the second parent adoption at this point, and I believe in Oregon, this is where the laws, sort of the ridiculousness of the laws around parenting rights, becomes really apparent, because in Oregon, it's the I'm not exactly sure of the terminology, but it's the woman who carries the child is assumed is given the parenting rights, and the woman who donates the egg is required to do the second parent adoption. Now, you might go to Washington State, for instance, and the rights would be assumed for the egg donor and not for the the woman who carries the child.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So, and then again, I think we need to keep sort of the perspective of place and privilege that we have to some extent in Oregon, which is that many states ban adoption outright and foster parenting for same couple. In fact, you know, the next wave of of battles in legislatures and at the ballots across the country is being waged on the issue of parenting rights. There are adoption bans up in many states. There was legislation introduced this last session of the Oregon legislature that would have limited the rights of gays and lesbians to adopt in the state of Oregon.
There was an interesting piece of legislation that was proposed, I believe, in Illinois and Winnoye, as quickly shut down. But this legislator decided to propose that anybody who was wanting to use sperm bank services would need to go through a parental screening. And a lot of sperm banks do, or a lot of reproductive clinics require that you go through sort of a counseling process. But this one was basically you would have to prove that you were in a heterosexual relationship in order to be able to go through with insemination procedures, which it was quickly dropped because she didn't have enough time to work it through. But that's another, I'm afraid that would be another front on which our rights and abilities and parent would be attacked.
Well, what you're suggesting also is still a workaround, and that's actually now a $10,000 procedure, what you're suggesting, simply to get parenting rights that should already be in place.
Right. Can science take a bit further even and get to the point where DNA can be implanted with DNA science and so forth that eliminates sperm altogether?
I rode with this lady to the Michigan Women's Music Festival who was absolutely convinced that this was, and this was 10 years ago, that this was the next wave, that you could actually extract DNA from an egg of one woman and combine it with the egg of another woman. And quite frankly, I hope we never get to that point because, I mean, you know, I don't think.
Well, thanks, girls, for that. You know, at least we have some views. But thanks for your program, too.
Well, I don't know if I'm a girl, but I would thank you, women, for admitting
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, no, okay. I would spell that G-R-R-R-R-L, of course.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. That was interesting. So, finally, I want to talk about the other mother part, because the other mother, it's really interesting. I never anticipated being the other mother. I always thought that in my partnership I would be the one to carry the child. In all the relationships I've had since I came out at the age of 18, you know, if they were serious, we talked about it, about kids, and I've never had a partner who wanted to carry a child. The serious ones all wanted to have children eventually, but none of them wanted to actually carry the child. And so when I met and fell in love with my wife, Melissa, I was just like, oh, okay, yeah, that would be great. You want to do this too? And she's older, and it worked out better for us that she would carry the child first. And I was like, secretly in my heart, I was worried about the emotions around that I would have, because she's getting to do something that if I were not a lesbian, I'm sure would have happened much earlier than this. Probably not of my own deciding, just because I've always wanted to parent so much. So anyway, I was wondering how. If carrying a child was something that you wanted to do, how you decided to do it in your families, and what it's been like in the next 10 minutes, what it's been like to be the non-caring, the non-biological mom.
I can't have a child unless we do some extreme interventions. And that was a huge source of grief for me. And at various points in our pregnancy, I would have these little breakdowns, and I think a lot more of that's wrapped up in the fact that my mother's passed on, that I really wanted that strong biological daughter-mother bond again. And now that my daughter's here, the bonds we have are so strong, and I hear that they get stronger once nursing stops, but she definitely prefers the other mom, you know, her birth mom to her other mom, and I don't feel less like a mom. I just feel some pangs sometimes that I'm not the one breastfeeding her. I'm not the one that she turns to immediately when she comes home at the end of the day. But I think it's a wonderful struggle. It's a constant burning of my ego, you know. And whether it was this issue or something else, I think that's what raising children's about. You get to constantly get outside yourself and get over yourself.
Yeah, the humility factor.
That's really well said, Myra. I think that I had to sort of grieve that letting go of that need and desire to have the primary connection with the child, and I have had a tough time. I think at different points. I think right after the birth, it was really hard for there to be so much of the questions and the energy was directed at my partner who had given birth. For good reason. I mean, she went through a hell of a lot. You know, we went to the hospital on Sunday. The baby was born on Tuesday. That's a long labor. But there was part of me sort of clamoring for that, some of that attention. And, you know, hey, this has been life-changing for me, too. You know, it is a big deal. And I think part of the difficulty I had as well was that there's so much, you know, people can be sort of insensitive about the whole donor thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
that they prescribe some, you know, some sort of relevance, I guess, to, you know, the person who helped us to biologically create this child that I felt at times took away from me, and that was hard. And you know, a lot of it is ego, and some of it is selfishness. But that's sort of the reality that I faced, and some of the issues that came up for me. And I think it's an ongoing process. You know,
I think it's interesting that we're faced with the prospects of being mothers, but not you know, and I think, you know, women who adopt and who foster might go through this as well, that you're a mother but you haven't given birth. And for us, there's also the fact that our partner is also the mother. I'm not a dad. Like,
right.
I don't have the dad role. Like, for instance, our baby shower was for two moms. And how do you negotiate that, the situation, which is like, you know, so I'm not giving birth. So really, the shower is for my partner. It's really for our baby. But she's, you know, she's the one who's pregnant. But I'm not a dad, so I do think I should go. You know, it's this weird negotiation where, you know,
well, it's one of those places where your life sort of butts up against tradition and you know, and convention in a way.
It's a framework I can't get outside of sometimes, because I go off to work every day, 8:30 to 5, and I'm the breadwinner.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I come home and see Aria for an hour or two before she falls asleep, and I sit at work and go, I miss my kid, and who signed me up to be dad? And then I realize it's not dad, it's breadwinner.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the person who's going to really financially support the family as best I can, and that's a loving thing I do every day, and I just have to make the most of my weekends with her.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, it gave me an incredible respect for dads, for fathers.
Yeah.
You know, you going into this, I had always been the half of our couple that people had seen as the mothering type and the nurturing type. I mean, Katie's a lot more athletic and butchy than I am. So I think it surprised a lot of people that she was the one to carry the child. And, you know, and there is that connection, particularly with the breastfeeding. And when an infant is fussy and needy, they turn to that parent much more easily. And wow, did that just, you know, it brought up all sorts of, you know, like childhood rejection issues, like being the last one picked on the playground or whatever it was. And so it gave me a much greater appreciation for the young fathers in my life, who at times I would look at and think, you know, hey, get in there and get more involved or whatever. And it's hard. It's hard to get in there and get more involved when there is a sense of rejection at times with an infant who just wants
a nurse. And also there's like a definite innate language they have for each other.
Yeah.
And reading each other's signals that I'm not privy to.
Right. It's true.
Well, you guys, this has been wonderful. And I just wanted to thank you so much for coming in and having this conversation, and for co-founding Plop, and for Myra, and for Gina doing the work that you do with Basic Rights Oregon, and as fabulous mommies, I'm sure. I've seen Gina be a mommy. I know she's fabulous, but I have a sneaking suspicion you're a fabulous mommy too, Myra. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to Locus Focus Talk Radio here on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I would love to tell you what's happening the rest of the morning, but I don't have one of those sheets. So next Wednesday, we're going to have another installment of the Whole Communities Radio Project. And we're talking about the Damascus Project. So I hope you tune in next Wednesday for that. And have a lovely day.
Hey, look at that over there. Hey, what's that?